before we start, I just ask the audience if you can move forward so that people who are coming from behind can have room. Inshallah, thank you. Say the salawat, please.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين صلاة وسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين أبي القاسم محمد
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
على آله الطيبين الظاهرين المعصومين. First of all, just I want to acknowledge Alayhi Musavi, who is a greater alim than me being a student, sitting here in front of him and speaking. I will ask for his dua, so inshallah, that I can say something in his presence, which I feel already embarrassed, but inshallah, you know, Allah help me, and inshallah, with your dua, fadwa, shumar, inshallah.
Inshallah.
Salah salawat.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
As an individual, we have in nature that has been put into us. And this nature has two aspects. The nature that we have has two aspects. The first aspect is fitrat, that Allah speaks about in the Quran. Fitrat Allah allati fatara an-nasa alayh. That fitrat is an aspect of our nature. And then there's a second aspect of our nature, which is called tabi'at. This is also a part of our nature. Now the difference between these two is that fitrah is that inclination that pushes us towards achieving the purpose of our creation. Fitrah is that inclination that pushes us towards achieving the purpose for which we have been created. As opposed to tabi'at, which is an inclination we have that pushes us to fulfill our earthly needs, to fulfill our desires. And it doesn't have to be desires, even our needs. For example, hunger is a need. And when we, this inclination to fulfill it, this is tabi'at. And we, when we want to fulfill this need, not only do we fulfill it, but we want to do it in the best way possible. So if you have a choice between fast food and fine dining, we will choose fine dining. Just like that, tabi'at is that force, that inclination we have, that pushes us to fulfill these needs. Our culture is an outcome of our tabiat. The culture that we have made for ourselves, our way of life we have made for ourselves, is an outcome of tabiat. Fitrat, it doesn't incline us towards this. It inclines us to those things that will help us to achieve our purpose, why we have been created. That's what it's for. And hence we see that just like individuals have these two aspects, so also nations and societies have these two aspects. One aspect that they have is their fitrat. The second aspect they have is their tabi'at. Those nations that have progressed and advanced in their tabi'at are nations that, in the eyes of the world, are regarded as successful. And that's why you see that people who go and try to fulfill their tabi'at are people who build better homes for themselves, eat better food for themselves, get better security for themselves. These are all pursuit of our tabiat, as opposed to our fitrat. Now, if a nation you see who has advanced in fulfilling their tabiat, you see will have bigger buildings, better roads. It means that they have fulfilled their tabiat, they have progressed in their tabiat. But it doesn't mean that they have advanced in their fitrat. You see, their fitrat, that inclination that's pushing them towards achieving the greater purpose, the purpose for which they are created, you see, if they don't go after that and ignore it and just run after tabiat, then they end up having big buildings and living in big homes, but themselves being small persons. That's why in the world we see today, we see that the buildings have become bigger, but the people have become smaller. As opposed to there was time and places also where people are living in small huts. The homes that they have are small, but those people are big. Those people are big. What makes us great is not fulfilling our tabiat. What makes a human being and the human race great is by fulfilling our fitrat. It is this fitrat that makes us great. Now, just in that regard, if you understood the difference between the two, we see that those who ignore their fitrat, they end up becoming small. We have a conscience. As a people also, we have a conscience. Any community you go to, you analyze it by this way. What have they done for their fitrat? And what have they done for their tabiat? And by looking at this too, any community you can analyze and say that yes, they have advanced as a human being, they have advanced as insan and in achieving their purpose. And whenever you see a community, for example, building a big masjid, but themselves being small, they end up doing what? They have ignored their fitrat. Instead, they went to tabiat. The idea for us, both of these are needs. Fitrat is a need and tabiat is a need. But fitrat is what makes us great. What makes us a human being, what makes us bigger people. Now, when any community, what happens is that when they ignore their fitrat, the first thing that dies in them is conscience. The first thing that they let go of and sacrifice is their conscience, their zamir. This is what is sacrificed first. Because when this zamir, it flourishes, it grows when you advance in your fitrat, when you let your fitrat lead you. You let that inclination lead you that is helping you achieve the purpose of your creation. And hence when people are dead in their conscience, then really, any subjugator can subjugate them, and any dhulm can happen to them, and they would not have the conscience to rise up against it. So how do you destroy a community? How do you destroy a community? By helping them to ignore their fitrat and say, this is not important, your tabi'at is important, look after this. Look after this. Pay attention to this and focus on that. Once if people start to focus on their tabi'at and not their fitrat, that's the easiest way to destroy a community. And once that community is destroyed, now what happens? In order for you to give it life, now there has to be something done to it. That conscience needs to be shaken. It needs to be brought about again. It needs to be given life again. My friends, just in explaining this, now, did Allah make a system for us by which this fitrat that we have can be nourished? As a society, I'm saying, not as an individual. As a society, as an ummah, as a nation, did Allah create and make and give a system to us by which our nature of our fitrah can flourish and that we can achieve that purpose of our existence? Or did Allah say, no, I leave it up to you and I will not help you here? Now the question, the answer is obvious. And yes, Allah did create a system. He did give that system. And that system, for our fitrahs, to achieve our purpose, was the wilayat of Ahlul Bayt.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
You see, neither was Imam Hussein an individual, and neither was Yazid an individual. Imam Hussein was a representation, a manifestation of a character. And so was Yazid, a manifestation of a character. Imam Hussein is a representation of the fitrat of insan. Yazid is a representation of the tabi'at of insan. You see, this is where the two poles collided with each other. But here, the issue is this. Karbala is the cornerstone of our deen. Ashura is the axis on which our faith runs on. Imam Hussein and his mission and the shahadat of Imam Hussein and the companions is our history from which we take root from and we learn from. Every year, if a Shia doesn't know anything or doesn't come for anything, even he misses Eid prayer, but you see, really, you would hardly find a Shia who would miss Ashura. There's a sense of shame that comes about, person, you know, missing Ashura. It's hard for a Shia, you know. Where are you in Ashura? It's like, you know, where would I be? It's hard for him to miss that, right? Not here in America, you know, if it comes in the weekend, you know, people have, you know, on a weekday, people have a problem with that. But still they come. Right? They take off and they come. There is that shame that how can I not go? So this is one of those events, one of those things that really binds us together and brings us together. And also in our deen, my friends, we know that all the imams emphasized Imam Hussein. They all asked us to focus on Imam Hussein. On every event that we have throughout the year, they asked us to remember Imam Hussein. And they said, even on Eid al-Fitr, you read the ziyarat of Imam Hussein. On 15 Shaban, you read the ziyarat of Imam Hussein. So this emphasis, why this emphasis on Imam Hussein? The first point I want to clear, and then we'll go on from here, so that we can learn some lessons. So this should be made clear. Why this emphasis on Imam Hussein? Because that will give us a perspective of what we are doing here in these days. Every shahadat that comes, especially in Muharram, we see that we are here, and all of you are here. Your presence here is a proof of that. So what is it? Why this emphasis on Imam Hussein? Why Imam Hussein is being, and we are told to always remember Imam Hussein? You see, my friends, Islam as a religion, right, as a message was given by the Prophet and the Imams. And when they gave the message, they gave it in the environment that they were living in the circumstances that they found themselves in. One of the issues we see is that the circumstances sometimes would not allow the imams to make things clear for the people, to make things known for the people, because the circumstance dictates how they are going to do things, what they are going to say, what is it that it's going to be told. It's different. Every circumstance is different. Sometimes, you know, you're in an awkward position, you can't say the truth openly. It happens to us also. Sometimes when we go to a new community who don't know anything, now we have to really be careful of what we are saying because they might not understand everything we say. Then you go to a learned community, right? Like Maulana was speaking about, that people who learn, who are always with ulama, they learn from ulama, you go there, you see it's much easier to talk. Why? Because people already understand things. So when you speak, you're not afraid that they will misunderstand. So circumstances dictate what you can and cannot say, what you can and cannot preach. They dictate that. And hence when we look at the lives of the a'imma, we see that every imam found himself in a different circumstance, in a different place. And hence, there were clouds of doubts in the message that they were giving. Now the message they gave was the same. But because the circumstances were different, what was reaching us was not clear. You know, for example, you know, like you use a cell phone. A cell phone, when you use it, you will see that if the signal is good, you know, then the voice is better and the receiver also hears you better. But when the signal is bad, you know, then you're like, I can't listen to it. Now, me, who's on this side, I'm speaking to you and what I'm saying is clear. But is what you hearing clear or not? So what I'm saying is loud and clear to me. I'm saying at the same tone and at the same pitch. Now when you are listening to it, is it clear for you when you're listening to it? See, this is the difference between the circumstances of one imam to another. That's why when we see the time of Imam Ali alayhi salam, now when you look at his time, you look at it and you see that, wow, Imam Ali was so clear. He was the same as Imam Hassan, as Imam Hussein, as every other imam. What he was saying was very clear. But why is it that even today people have a problem with understanding and they compare Imam Ali to all the other cats who are around in his time? Right? All these other characters that were around, they're saying, you know, well, he's there also. What do you mean he's there? Compared to Imam Ali, he should be nobody. And it should be clear, right? I mean, for us it's clear, right? I mean, why would we even put them in the same sentence? Even to put them in the same sentence is an insult to Imam Ali. Yeah, offensive, you know? I mean, you know, like that. This is the case. I mean, why is it this doubt is still there? Really, why this doubt is still there in the minds of people? Because of the circumstances. The circumstances, the environment that Imam Ali found himself in was very difficult to let the truth out. And the same happened with all the rest of the imams. Now you see that the circumstance that Imam Hussein found himself in gave him the best opportunity and the clearest field and the best plane and the finest lens to give the message that all the other imams were giving. But in Karbala, when he gave the message, it was heard loud and clear. See, it was heard loud and clear. So Karbala is unique because of the circumstance that Imam Hussein found himself in. The message was so clear for us that there's no doubt where the truth is and where it's falsehood. And that's why when you read Ziyarat Ashura or any of these ziyarat that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam had taught us, what you understand from it is really that the only people where, you know, when you give the lanat, right, and when you give the curse, you see the only people that Imam took by name is Yazid. Is Yazid. None of his predecessors, you see, the Imam did not take their name. You know, he said, you know, that lanat on the first and the second, the third and fourth and the fifth being Yazid. Why this Yazid's name was taken? Because in that time that Imam Hussein found himself in, because the truth was so clear, falsehood was also clear. Falsehood was also clear, so you can take the name because you know that this is false. But every other time, there were clouds of doubts. People were confused. In Siffin, people were confused. on this side and that side. People were advising Imam Ali, stop this fight. How many Muslims are you going to kill? It's his own people, not others. His own people are confused. So you see, there was that confusion. Karbala is that lens that gives us that message of Islam in the clearest way. This is the first thing. Now, the second question is this, my friends, before I go on, is this, that if Karbala is the clearest lens of Islam, and Islam that has been taught in Karbala is the clearest, more than any other time in the Imam's history, the question is, did Imam Hussein in Karbala teach all of Islam or some of Islam? If this is the best lens that the whole history of Ahlul Bayt found themselves in, was all of Islam shown there or no, some of Islam was shown there? Yeah, you know, if some of Islam was shown, then it means some of Islam is very clear and the other is shady. The other, there's doubts. You can always argue, you can always bring out other sides, perspectives, debate the point. My friends, the actual answer is that in Karbala, all of Islam was taught. All of Islam was taught in Karbala. Whatever we need to know in Islam has been taught in Karbala by Imam Hussein. This is the reality. Everything that we need to know has been taught. Now tell me, when we listen to the majalis of Imam Hussein, of Ashura, of Muharram, the issue right now what we face is that are we stuck? Because sometimes what happens is that we learn certain lessons that are obvious. Certain lessons are very obvious. Imam Hussein stood against Zalim. Is that obvious? Yeah, we learned that. Imam Hussein stood for the Mazloom. Is that right? Yes, that's right. This is obvious. Imam Hussein taught us the lesson of Shahadat. Is that obvious? Yes, it is obvious, right? Okay. But now what happens is that we took these obvious lessons and we started repeating them and wanting to learn them very well. Well, here's what happens. 1400 years have passed and we keep on repeating the same lessons over and over and over again. And the idea comes about is that the only thing that Imam Hussein taught? Isn't there anything else that he taught? You see, obvious lessons are easy to learn, but, you know, here's the thing. If we haven't learned the lesson of Shahada in 1400 years of repetition, then there's nothing wrong with the message. We need to get ourselves analyzed. Really, for 1400 years we have been repeating the lesson of Shahada. If we are not ready for Shahada, then either there's something wrong with the message or there's something wrong with us. Why haven't we learned the lesson of Shahada yet? See, that's a whole different subject. But I'm raising this issue so you understand that these lessons should have been learned long time ago for a Shia. Yes, there are certain things that we have learned because of the majalis of Imam Hussein throughout these years that the people at that time did not have and we have, and there's no way that we as a Shia, and I'm thinking, would allow Imam Hussein, if something like that happened to Imam Hussein today, I don't think that the Shias would allow that to happen. Am I fair in this statement? Do you think that you will rise up if Imam Hussein is in a siege right now? You would rise up, right? You would say something, you would do something. So this sense of honor and shame, and if that which happened to Imam Hussein and his family, and the woman, if it happened today, you see, the Shias would not stay quiet, unlike those times, right? So there are certain lessons that I think are ingrained in us. Certain lessons are ingrained in us. But then we need to see and go deeper into this. The society that Imam Hussein was faced with was a dead society. In their conscience, they were dead because they ran after tabi'at, they ignored their fitrat. And how did Imam Hussein bring it about? Just this I want to explain a little bit. Inshallah, if we have time, we will go into it later. How did Imam Hussein bring this about? What did happen? What actually happened? You see, when we want to learn the lessons of Karbala, you see, there are lessons that when you want to learn those lessons that are hidden in Karbala, you have to think a little bit deeper. Who was Imam Hussein, first of all, who was Imam Hussein trying to fight against? Who was the opposition of Imam Hussein? Who was it that Imam Hussein wanted to bring in the boxing ring? He said, come on, let's fight. Who did he want to bring out? You see, that's where the first mistake happened. My friends, Imam Hussein was not trying to fight Yazid. And that is a mistake that we usually make when we look at the history of Karbala. Imam Hussein was not trying to fight Yazid. Because they say, you know, that Imam Hussein fought Yazid. No, Imam Hussein was not trying to fight Yazid. He wasn't even trying to expose Yazid. There was no need for him to expose Yazid. Yazid was already exposed. Everyone knew who Yazid was. One time, Muawiyah had sent Yazid on a state tour to introduce him to the people. So Yazid came to Medina. He came to Medina and there he was, they had a big gathering for him. They invited all the elders and the ulama of Medina to come and meet Yazid. The prince, as an introduction so that they know Yazid. And Muawiyah obviously had sent with Yazid his advisors to make sure that this goes well. So Yazid, before the event started and the invitation were given and people were coming at this time, before it all started, what Yazid did is that he got drunk, as usual. Right? He got drunk. And he was completely, wiped out. Now these guys now are saying that these people are going to come, how Yazid is going to come in front of them, what's going to happen to them, how is this going to work. So what happened is that they, put some clothes on him, got him ready, and put some perfume on him, so no one smells this breath of alcohol and wine that was coming, and they sat him down on a seat. Now everyone in Medina was trying to come and meet Yazid. All these people are coming in, they're smelling, obviously. The smell can't be hidden. It was mixed with the perfume and some strange smell was coming. And they noticed it. Now, Imam Hussein also came to that gathering. Imam Hussein came to that gathering and as soon as he entered there, he noticed the smell. Now the others wouldn't dare say anything, so they knew what it was, they didn't want to say anything. They didn't want to say anything because they knew if they say something, their head will be chopped off, or they'll disappear, for some reason. But Imam Hussein wasn't afraid. He wasn't afraid of that. So what he did is that he right away protested and said that this person is drunk. This is an insult to us and the gathering here for you to have this person here is drunk. Said, no, he's not drunk. Who said he's drunk? This and that. He said, you can smell this. No, he said, this is a new perfume from Africa. A new perfume. We can't fool Imam Hussein. Imam Hussein said, listen, do not lie. This person is drunk. And right away. Now, Yazid obviously himself was an impatient man. He was a spoiled brat, He was a prince and, he didn't have patience for all this. Overdoing himself, even just waiting there like that, sitting there like that without having his fun. So as soon as he heard this protest and as soon as he said this, right, he just had enough of it. He said, heck with this, bring out the alcohol. Bring out the alcohol. And the servant got him the alcohol, he poured some drink and offered it to Imam Hussein. Here, take this. Imam Hussein turned around, and walked out. Now tell me, was Imam Hussein trying to expose Yazid in Karbala? No, everyone knew who Yazid was. He wasn't fighting Yazid. Everyone knew who Yazid was. You know, there was... What was the enemy that Imam Hussein was trying to fight? This is where you see the lessons of Karbala really help us understand ideology. Really, that we understand ideology through these things. When we look at it, how and what Imam Hussein was trying to bring out, that is really... Then you say, Subhanallah, this is what's going on. You see, if you go back a bit, in the time of Imam Ali, Imam Ali was faced with different people, different groups of people that he was trying to, you know, expose. He was trying to make the people realize the wrong in them. You know, the people who came out in Jamal. Imam Ali, he was not only just trying to fight them, he was trying to expose their ideology as being wrong. That's what was more important, that people understand what these people did was wrong, so that this never happens again. And then those people who came out in Siffin and Muawiyah, for example, Imam Ali was not just trying to kill Muawiyah, but he was trying to prove to everyone else why he was wrong in doing so. Why was Muawiyah wrong in standing up? This is the reason that even when Abdullah ibn Abbas was trying to tell Imam Ali, stop fighting, you know, this is not a good fight, we're going to get killed and this and that, you know, let's regroup and fight, Imam Ali was saying no. Ibn Abbas even went to the extent that you were that person who wasn't even interested in government. It was you who said, you know, that to me, this government of yours is not even worth my slippers. My broken slippers. My broken slippers are worth more than that. Then why is it that you now, after you got it, are trying to fight to the end with this guy? You see, all of these things, but Imam Ali was adamant. He wasn't trying to kill Muawiyah, he was trying to prove that the ideology of Muawiyah and those who are with him is wrong. And he exposed it. Then he exposed the people of Nahrawan, the Kharijis. He exposed those people. But there was one group of people that Imam Ali was not able to bring out. He was not able to fight with. And that was a dangerous group. That was a dangerous group that he wasn't able to fight with, and he could not, the circumstances didn't allow him to expose them, that group of people. Even Imam Hassan could not expose those people. Who was that group? What was that group? You see, and here's the thing, my friends. Unfortunately, what happens is this, right? When you look at the group, and I'll mention the group, who that group is. But before I even mention their name, right? Let's see that when we want to, for example, blame a group for doing something wrong, you know, or planning against Islam, or plotting against Islam, you know, the worst thing we do is that we blame a group that is unseen, there's no evidence of its existence, or it is a fringe group that has nothing to do with anything, or maybe they're behind it and we don't recognize it, and we blame groups like that. In fact, we make up a whole ideologies based on that. The Freemasons, the Illuminati, you know, these are people that are, oh, they're behind it. They're the ones who are orchestrating everything, this and that. And what happened is that while we are blaming these so-called invisible groups, the enemies are doing their job. Openly. They're killing you openly. And you're saying, oh, there are these groups behind you. You know? Now, who are the Illuminati? The Illuminati are the ones who are planning against Islam and they're trying to kill Muslims, this and that. There's no need for an invisible enemy. The open enemy is doing it. Why are you even blaming those people, man? This is a distraction. And what happened is that we run after these things to create distraction for ourselves, not even recognizing where the real enemy is. The real enemy is right out there in front of you. And here is where we don't pay attention to. In fact, the enemy that Imam Hussein wanted to fight is still respected by many people. They are still respected by many people. Who was it that Imam Hussein was trying to bring forward? That Imam Ali could not handle. That Imam Hassan could not handle. Or I should say that Imam Ali was not able to do it because of the circumstances he found himself in. Could not bring them out. Imam Hassan could not bring them out. You know that group? That invisible group, that group that is there, that was always a cause of problem for Imam Ali and Imam Hassan. It was an eyesore for them. It was a bone that was stuck in their throat that they could not do anything about. And all of these tyrants, Moabiah, and all of these tyrants, they stood up with the backing and support of this group. You know what that group was that Imam Hussein wanted to bring forward? And he did expose them in Karbala. This group is called the people. It is called the people. Yes, Imam Hussein was trying to bring out this group, the people. Yes. These were the same people who, in the time of Imam Ali, then Muawiyah stood up because of the help of the people. The people was what Imam Hussein was trying to expose. Because it's the people who let false people become Khalifa. It's the people who let Muawiyah become Amirul Mu'mineen. It's the people who allowed this to happen. It's the people. And Imam Hussein said, you know what? This enemy that is there, which is the people, I want to bring them out in the battlefield. And I want to expose them in front of the world. And this is the reason why you see that Imam Hussein is the only Imam. The only Imam. No other Imam. The only Imam is Imam Hussein who was killed by the people. Ibn Muljim killed Imam Ali. We know the people who killed, each individual who killed the Imams. But it was the people that came out to kill Imam Hussein. All of them, in masses. They came to kill Imam Hussein. And Imam Hussein wanted that. He says, let them come out now. Because you were hiding behind Muawiyah's back. You were hiding behind Yazid's back. You were hiding behind all these people saying, we don't want to do anything with anyone. No, I want you to come out now. It was the people who killed Imam Hussein. It was the people who threw stones at the family of Imam Hussein. People did it. Not one person. The masses did it. My friends, this silent majority is the reason why the house of Fatima was burned down. This silent majority. These were the people. And this silent majority that's always there and they don't get involved in anything, but because they don't say anything, then every zalim is able to come forward and say, well, if the people were against us, they would have said something. Do you really think that if the people stood up against those small group of people who came to the house of Hazrat Fatima and knocked at her door, if they stood up, that they would dare to do that? They would never dare to do that. They did it because no one was saying anything. No one said anything. Everyone was giving their silent agreement. Yes, it's sad. I feel bad about it. Imam Hussein, when he died, you know, people were sad, they cried, and they are still doing the zulm. The person who snatched the earrings from Hazrat Sakina, when he snatched the earrings from her, he was crying. Tears were coming from his eyes, he was crying as he was snatching. And the person who saw him, he says, why are you crying for? He says, I'm crying because this is Ahlul Bayt and look what's happening to them. He said, why are you doing it? He said, because if I don't take them, someone else will take them. So it's better if I take them. So it's not that they're sad. Of course they're sad. They're really sad of what happened to Imam Hussein. Really, they're very sad of what happened to Imam Hussein. You know, they cry also. The issue is that, don't you understand what's going on? It is because of you that this is happening. Imam Hussein wanted to expose the people, my friends. And now, when he has exposed it, now he says, the idea is that when we learn Karbala, and when we know that Imam Hussein is trying to expose this people to us, then now anything that is based on the people must be condemned by us, if we understand Karbala. anytime anyone says, oh, the people, people, people are the one who killed Imam Hussein. People who killed Imam Hussein, why should I even trust them? Why should I do anything for them? They don't mean anything to me. If Imam Hussein is dear to me, then people have no meaning for me. See the lesson that Imam Hussein is teaching us. Think about it. Need to let that sink in. People came out. And that's what we see. Now, when the people came out, Imam Hussein wanted to expose them on one hand, but you see, he didn't want to expose them in order to condemn them. He wanted to expose them so that now we understand, really, not out of hatred he did it, out of love he did it. SubhanAllah. Here's another thing, my friends. Imam Hussein, when he wanted to expose people, he wanted to bring them out, not because he hated them, because he loved them. That's the only way to teach them, you know. Have you ever tried to fix someone who's on drugs? You know, someone is addicted to drugs. Right? How do you deal with the situation? Someone is addicted to drugs. You know, the first thing to do is to bring him out and make him accept that he has a problem. If you don't even bring him out, if you don't even point him out, if he doesn't come to that realization that he is doing wrong, that he is wrong, then there's nowhere to fix him. You will never be able to fix him. And this is the same thing in a society. In order for you to help it, you need to bring them out. Let them be exposed so that now they realize, now they need fixing. Now they need fixing. SubhanAllah. And this is what you see. This is the point. This is the point where the imamate of Imam Sajjad began. This is where it began. See that? Where, I mean, really, looking at Imam Sajjad, when you look at his life and where his imamate began, unlike any other imam, can you imagine this? His imamate is beginning in circumstances that are beyond our imagination. He is sick. The tents are being raided and burned. The women are panicking. The children are frightened. Their lives are in danger. And you see that the Imam opens his eyes to Imam Hussein. See that? No other Imam started the Imamate like that. And for him to start it like that, to begin like that, this is my responsibility now. To do what? To now finish and complete the job that Imam Hussein has left for me. Imam Hussein brought these people out, now I have to train them. I have to make them better. Give them and show them wilayat. SubhanAllah. This is, my friend, it wasn't easy for Imam Sajjad. On one hand, Imam Sajjad had the responsibility of speaking the truth. And letting be known what happened in Karbala and making it clear. On one hand, that's his job. On the second hand, he has to make sure that he doesn't get killed in the meanwhile. Because he is the only man left and they all want to kill him. He was saved many times by Hazrat Zainab. When they actually wanted to kill him, and Hazrat Zainab jumped in front of him and said, you have to kill me first. You know, and then they were like, okay, you know. They said, he's the only man, let him be. They have no other man amongst them. Let them be. He was saved like that, my friend. So he has to make sure that he's saved on the second hand. And the third thing, he has to make sure that the spirit of Hayhat min Nazilla is maintained. Because Imam Hussein, that was his slogan, Hayhat min Nazilla, that we will not humiliate ourselves. Humiliation is far from us. We will never become zaleel. No matter what happens to us, if we are killed, we will be killed with our heads raised up. And that spirit of Imam Hussein needed to be maintained. Not just in Imam Sajjad. That's easy for him. He's the Imam. But also the children. Also the family. Also the women. And he has to maintain that to make sure that they don't break down Can you imagine that? Because Imam Hussein, on the way to Karbala, he had a meeting with his family, his children and everyone. He had a meeting with them, and in that meeting, he told them about the difficulties that are going to happen. And then when he explained to them the difficulties that were going to happen, he told them that, listen, he said, don't say anything with your tongues. Don't do or say anything with your tongues that brings down your respect and value. This was his advice to his children. Sakina, to his daughters, to his nieces, he said, listen, do not say anything that will bring down your respect. La taqulu bi alsanatikum. Do not say anything with your tongue that will bring down your qadr, your value, your respect. Don't do anything. Can you imagine that? Now for Imam Sajjad, it's easy. But it was difficult for Sakina and the children. Can you imagine how hard it was? In Kufa, when someone came and offered sadaqah, he offered sadaqah to this girl. She said, what is this? She said, and they said, oh, you're poor, you're this, and this is from Aziz Sadaqah. She's hungry, she is thirsty, but you know what? She listens to the advice of her father, and she says, Ammati taqulu, my aunt has said, Inna sadaqata alayna haram. That sadaqah is haram on us, we cannot accept it. Can you imagine little children like that, behaving like this? Imam Sajjad had, you see, such a great task. In front, he has to speak the truth. On the same time, make sure that he doesn't get killed in the process. And on the third time, maintain that slogan of Hayat Milla Zilla. Now, he goes forward in this mission. Starts from Karbala, and he goes forward. Now you see how he has taken this mission forward. Everywhere you go, Imam Sajjad is, everywhere you go, he is giving speeches. Every time he finds a group of people, he starts speaking to them. He starts talking to them. You know what he's doing? Why is he giving all these speeches? Why is he doing that? My friends, these are things when you look at Imam Sajjad and you see how he has taken this caravan from Karbala to Sham and has given the message that was given in Karbala and related in Sham. How did he manage to do that? He was speaking about four basic things. Four things, my friends. It was who, what, where, and why. Four things he was speaking. He was just going and saying the same thing. Who was killed? Where was he killed? What happened? How did it happen? Is he explaining this? Why was he explaining this everywhere and all these people are hearing? Because Imam Sajjad knew that if he does not say it, then the media of Yazid and Bani Umayyah will spin this tale in such a way that they will say Imam Hussein got sick and he died in Karbala. In order that history be written down and nothing can be changed from history, he gave speeches at every corner and every place, wherever he found a group of people. He was speaking there. And it was difficult for him to speak also, because his hands and feet are tied in chains. There are ladies that are around him, there are heads that are on a spear. His beloved ones have just died. Just imagine that circumstances, you are now focusing on your message. That this is the message. This is what happened, this is who did it, this is what, how it happened, this is where it happened. Explaining each of these things, Imam Sajjad made sure that the history of Karbala cannot be changed. He was the first zakir of Imam Hussein. And the masahib of Imam Hussein. That was Imam Sajjad, my friends. This is how he brought that message to Shah. This is how he brought that message to Shah. It was difficult for him to deal with people. You know, these people, they were dead in their conscience, they were dead. When they came to Kufa, the person who was given the charge to take the Ahlul Bayt and hold them until Ibn Ziyad gets ready, that person was one of those people who liked Ahlul Bayt. He came to Imam Sajjad. He cried before him. He was sorry about what happened. He was saying, is there anything I can do to help you? Whatever I can do to help you, let me know, and this and that. That same person who's offering help, who's there and who's trying to give condolences to Imam Sajjad, the same person, they gave him 300 dinar and he sold the Ahlul Bayt for 300 dinar. Can you imagine that? Friends, this is where fitrat is what we need to pursue. What is fitrat? That is what gives us conscience to say that, what am I doing here? What is wrong with me? Because you know, when these people cried in front of Imam Sajjad, he looked at Zainab and says, Aunt Zainab, do you see these people are crying? Look at them crying, look at them crying. He says, you are the same people who promised my father that you will help them and betrayed him. And now you cry. Subhanallah. This is the people Imam Sajjad is saying. So now Imam Sajjad takes this caravan. He takes this caravan. But throughout the journey, there were difficulties. But Sham was something unique. Sham was a devastating experience for Imam Sajjad. Really, we know some of the history of Sham and what happened in Sham. Brothers, you all know what happened in Karbala. Right? You all know what happened in Karbala. You know what happened throughout the way. Some of the history, not too much. We have certain history that's written there and we read it all the time. You know what happened in Sham and how the Ahlul Bayt were gathered there and what happened to them. You know all these things. Really, my friends, can you look at all these things? And we all cry because of the tragic circumstances that these are. But I want you to just think about this, right? Really, the history we know about Sham, does that justify, really, does that justify that throughout his life, Imam Sajjad, throughout his life, every time he was asked, where is the most toughest and the most difficult time you had, the greatest suffering you had, he said, Asham, Asham, Asham. Based on this saying of Imam Sajjad, what happened in Sham? That Imam Sajjad, for his whole life, is remembering Sham. My friends, history does not do justice. The books of Maqtal do not do justice as to what happened in Sham. It is the crying and mourning of Imam Sajjad saying, Asham, 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 that is making us devastated inside. Imam, what happened in Sham that you're crying so much? What don't we know about that you are crying so much in Sham? Can you imagine this, my friends? When someone asked him, he said, Asham, and he said, he asked him a question. He said, why Sham? I thought your relatives were killed in Karbala. Why was Sham the toughest? He says, because Shahadat is our way of life. Rasulullah has taught us that. We are ready and willing to give our life for Allah any moment that Allah asks for it. But taking our woman, taking our wives and children and wives and mothers out in the bazaar and making them spectacle in front of people, this is not what Rasulullah taught us. This is not what Rasulullah taught us. Every incident that happened in Sham was a spear in the heart of Imam Sajjad. He came to the gate of Sham and they were stopped over there at the gate of Sham. My friend, really, I want you to understand this. All of you men, women out there, you, may Allah bless you and may Allah give you more iman and more tawfiq. May Allah raise your izzat. May Allah make your izzat and your sharaf and your honor greater. You, when you go out When you see, for example, I'm just saying this, my friend, so you just take that example for yourself and feel for Imam Sajjad. If you are out with your own mother or your own sister, and part of their hijab is removed, and you see other people looking right away, you remind them, go ahead, where your hair is showing, put it away. And imagine this feeling we have. Just a little bit, that shame we have, that we would not want that. This is honor, my friends. Now just feel for Imam Sajjad, who's out there, and you cannot even give hijab to the ladies. People look at... They were stopped at the gate. You know, they were stopped at the gate. How can I say this? But this is history. How can I say this? And I say this with all... I say this with all respect and all honor, my friend, to keep it in place. But this is devastating. Imam Sajjad was faced with this, you know. Imam Sajjad, his hands are tied. His feet are tied in chains. And he's brought like that in front of the gate of Sham, and people are looking at them as spectacles. Some wretched man comes up there and sees this and says, who are these? They said they're prisoners of war. They're prisoners of war that are being brought in. He looks at the girls and points to one and said, let me buy this one. Oh, Imam Sajjad! That is Imam Sajjad, and we see his shahada, and we bear his shahada today, and we are saying farewell to him, and we are saying farewell to our Imam, who for 35 years after Karbala he lived, and every time, every moment of that 35 years, who used to grieve for Hussein, who used to cry for Hussein and his family. Anytime someone would bring him food, he would look at the food and start crying. Every time someone would bring him water, he would cry so much that it said that the water in the cup will be raised up. There will be more fluid in there. That's how many tears he would shed. Ajarakumul Allah, may Allah bless you, my friends. You give your condolences, And I'm telling you this. You know, when this happened, and he used to cry so much that his servants would be afraid for his life. They would be afraid for his life, and they would tell Imam Sajjad, that please don't cry, you're going to kill yourself with this crying. Because they used to see how much it used to hurt him, and how badly it used to affect his health. They used to say, do not cry. Don't you see Allah says in the Quran that you should not kill yourself by your own hands? They used to eat an ayat for him. And Imam Sajjad looked at them and just said one thing. You know, Imam Sajjad just said one thing. He said, Yaqub lost his one son. Yaqub knew he wasn't dead. Yaqub knew he wasn't dead, but he cried so much that he lost his eyesight. He said, I lost 17 of my beloved family. Slaughtered. Thirsty in Karbala. Why should I cry? Imam Sajjad, it is said, every time he used to go across a butcher shop, the butchers in Medina would close down the shop. They would close
God. And they will let him pass before they open it up. Because every time that Imam Sajjad would see a dead sheep hanging as a habit, he would come there and say, did you give him water before you slaughtered him? Did you give him water before you slaughtered him? They said, Yabna Rasulullah, we are from the ummah of your grandfather. Yes, we gave them water to the extent that they turned their head 3 times. And Imam Sajjad would turn towards Medina, would turn towards the grave of his grandfather and said, Ya Jaddi Rasulullah, do you see, even the animals that are killed are given water before they're killed. My father in Karbala was killed without water.
Mato. Sim.